welcome to another episode in our criminal calendar. I have to tell you that I feel like a particular moron today because our guest, Daniel Silva, is a television professional. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you? Why do you feel like a moron?
Well, I think that you invite somebody who did programming for CNN to be my guest on cable television.
I was at CNN. I was not a pioneer. I was not one of the founding fathers, but I did come to CNN, I guess, 8 years into this great experiment known as all news cable television. And, you know, we did things on the cheap compared to the networks, too. So not to say that this is on the cheap, but it was not always a bed of roses there. It's a lot better now.
I wish that in my literary life I actually had time to occasionally watch television or even go to the movies, but I find that the book world, it's just overwhelming. So if I make any, you know, sort of fluffs about television, I hope you'll forgive me. But you, if I remember right, you actually started off in journalism and you were at San Francisco State.
I was in graduate school at San Francisco State, and the Democratic Convention was coming to town. And United Press International offered me a 6-week temporary job. They had to have some grunts to do all the silly stuff while the staffers were working on the convention. And I got that 6-week temporary job, and at the end of it, they hired me full time. And so I didn't finish graduate school. I took the job, and then a short time later, I was offered a second job at the Peninsula Times Tribune in Palo Alto, so I would work 6 to 2 in San Francisco, get on Highway 101, go down the peninsula, work 4 to midnight at the Peninsula Times Tribune. So that's how I started my career.
You know, I was an undergraduate in Palo Alto. I can hardly remember the Peninsula Times Tribune.
It was a small paper based in Palo Alto. It folded at least 10 years ago. It was done under by the success of the San Jose paper, the Mercury News, sort of crushed it. But it was a small, feisty Palo Alto, but it covered all the peninsula, all those suburbs down there. And so I had my foot in. I was just so excited to have a job, I took them both.
I can well imagine. And then what? You went to Washington.
I went to Washington. I was transferred to the foreign desk in Washington for UPI, and I worked there for a couple of years. And in 1987, I was sent overseas and worked in the Middle East for a couple of years.
Were you in Cairo then?
I was based in Cairo. Lived in an apartment overlooking the Nile. It was a big, filthy, crowded, overcrowded mess, and I just adored it. I really loved Cairo. But I was also living part-time in the Persian Gulf, covering the Iran-Iraq war from time to time. So I sort of went back and forth between the two places. And while I was in the Persian Gulf, I met my wife-to-be, who is Jamie Gangel of NBC News. And one of us had to move, and it wasn't going to be her. And so I came back to Washington and went to work for CNN.
I asked you in part because so far you haven't had a whole book, at least, set in Cairo.
I am writing at least one more of the series that I'm working on, but I am stewing over a novel set in Cairo. I think it's sort of a perfect stage for a novel that I'm thinking about the Islam and our war on terror and some things like that. Early notion is what I would call it, but I do want to go back there and set a novel in Cairo.
Yeah, it seems a shame to waste the experience, especially if you liked it. I mean, I've heard conflicting reports. We've had a number of authors who've spent time in Cairo. Most seem to love it. A few have been repelled.
Well, I loved it, but it was hard to live there. We were sick all the time, foreign correspondents. You would go to a cocktail party and people just stand around, you know, discussing the latest gastrointestinal ailment from which they were suffering. We're all out in the open with it. But it was fascinating. And it was not a time when I never felt any anti-Americanism there. I would hang out with my office boys. They would just take me into the crummiest coffee houses and tea houses, and we'd play backgammon all night, and it was great. I think it has changed a great deal.
Since you were there?
I do. And Egypt has had its own, obviously, a lot of Islamic violence there. There was this terrible massacre in Upper Egypt of the tourists a few years ago. A lot of people don't really realize how much Al-Qaeda is born of that Egyptian tradition. The number two man to Osama bin Laden is an Egyptian. Ayman Zawahiri comes from Egypt. So it's a little bit dicey these days, I think.
And yet Egypt has a really strong Christian tradition, the whole Coptic Church.
It's an oppressed and they enjoy second-class status for the most part. And they live in fear in a lot of places, just as the Jewish community did that existed there before they were expelled. But it is in a lot of ways the center of the Muslim world. Al-Azhar University is the great Muslim university, and it envelops you when you're there. I mean, Islam is everywhere. You fall into the daily rhythm of the prayers and the Muslim Sabbath, and it's quite something.
Now that you have swum into my ken, so to speak, we published a series, Poison Pen Press, by Michael Pearson, English author, called The Mamre Zapped.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch, and they are very much in the same sort of style that you write, I think. I love them. They are set in the Egyptian protectorate. And the series is going to come to its natural end with the end of the First World War.
Hmm.
They won a lot of awards, and I think they are very intelligent. They're also a great way for people who want to understand some of the Middle East today, you know, to go back and look at some of the roots of how the West interfaced in the late 19th, early 20th century,
right.
You know, with Egypt.
And right after that came the birth of a group that would change the face of the Middle East, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood. They come out of Egypt in the 20s. They're formed there. And this Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic extremism, if you will, is an Egyptian product. It was born in Egypt in that period between the wars and has obviously had a great impact on the face of the Middle East.
Well, I can imagine that a book that you will write about this would be a real... Well, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
But enough of that. Let's talk about books you've actually written, just to get us going here.
Okay.
The Unlikely Spy, your first novel. What induced you to write fiction? Was it kind of a relief, in fact, from all the news coverage?
I always wanted to be a writer. And I grew up reading Alistair MacLean and guys like that, Eric Ambler. I took all my dad's books, Jack Higgins. And I always wanted to write thrillers. And I went into journalism because I thought it would be good training in the art of storytelling and would provide me with some interesting experiences, and that turned out to be the case. And I was at CNN, and I had moved into a sort of a management position. I was in charge of the unit that produced all of the political talk shows, Crossfire, Capital Gang, Late Edition, Inside Politics. I was running this menagerie filled with, you know, Patrick Buchanan and Michael Kinsley and Robert Novak and Jesse Jackson. These guys worked for me, worked with them every day. And I wasn't writing anymore, no more news writing, and I felt it was time to try. And I wanted to get as far away from my job as possible. And so every morning for a year or so, I went down and wrote before work, and that was the end result of it.
What was the background you chose for An Unlikely Spy? Or is it The Unlikely Spy?
The Unlikely Spy.
The Unlikely Spy.
It's set in England on the eve of D-Day, and it involves a plot to steal a little-known secret of the Normandy invasion. That was the plan to build artificial harbors to ferry supplies and tanks and machinery ashore after the invasion started. And the theory was that if you knew that they were building artificial harbors, you knew that they were coming at Normandy, which was the case. So they had to protect that secret guard it very jealously. And so I toyed with that notion, and it was a deception upon a deception upon a deception. And it did very well. It was on the Times list for about 5 weeks, if I remember correctly, and it started the ball rolling for me.
I find it fascinating that now that we are at a sufficient remove from the Second World War, that all kinds of aspects of it, which you've, you know, obviously deal with in some of your later books, have come out that would have been impossible to write about shortly after the war. Swiss banking, you know, a lot of the tangle over stolen art, things like that. The whole bit about the Catholic Church and hiding, you know, Nazis and whatever.
Right.
Is it? Did you write about World War II because it engaged you, or because it's a little bit easier, you know, to stand at a distance and
it engages
plot it
me.
Out?
It engaged me. It engages me still. And I have just enjoyed watching us. Europe wrestle with these questions about what I call the unfinished business of the Holocaust in the last few years. Part of it is just time and archives being opened and records and historians finally digging. And, you know, sometimes it takes a while for stuff to float to the surface. And
absolutely.
And also it needs a period of reassessment as well.
Yeah.
And that's really what happened with the Vatican. But, you know, it is the event that shaped our modern world like no other, in my opinion, and I like sifting through the threads of it.
I think it's fascinating. I have a lot of trouble with World War I for some reason or other. It's a period in history. To me, it's so tragic because nothing actually, in the end, they weren't fighting for the same kinds of goals, and in the end, there was this horrible slaughter for what?
Because a terrorist in Sarajevo assassinated an archduke, and the alliances were lined up. I mean, I've thought about toying with that. The start of the war. The start of the war to me is always the tragedy of the war, and then of course it leads to this terrible slaughter and stalemate on the battlefields of Europe.
But it was really much more of a game. I mean, you had all these political alignments that sort of came in. I thought, you know, World War II was a war that was, I thought, easier to identify.
Certainly.
The issues.
Good versus evil.
Yeah, it really was. And I often marvel, too. I mean, one of the things as a student of history I just find completely fascinating is why didn't Hitler read more about Napoleon, or at least why didn't he apply it?
Yeah, this great battlefield tactician that fights a war in the West and then turns and invades Russia.
Falls right into the same, you know, and I mean, I don't know if it was hubris or
definitely
what
it was. Hubris.
Do you think that was the motivating deal?
Yeah.
Or just because he couldn't manage to get England, so he had to go and, you know, turn the other direction?
He always wanted it and thought he could take it all. And it was the great mistake, and unfortunately for the Jews, it was the trigger that led to the Holocaust, because he invades Russia and suddenly finds himself, and I forget the numbers, but it must have been around 8 million Jews living within territory that he now ruled. And that was too many, so Operation Barbarossa would turn out to be, Hitler's mistake would also turn out to be a terrible trigger for European Jewish community. It would lead to their destruction.
Well, you've come to that with the books about Ellen, but before that you wrote two books after The Unlikely Spy, and if I remember, it was Northern Ireland.
I wrote a book called The Mark of the Assassin,
right.
Was the second one. It was a sort of a political thriller dealing, set in, largely in Washington, but around Europe as well, dealing with the downing of an American jet and who was behind it. Then I wrote a book set in Northern Ireland called The Marching Season.
And that had the same character, right?
Had
the
same
Osborne character?
A guy named Michael Osborne, a CIA counterterrorism officer. While the books did fine, I wasn't entirely happy with them. I felt I had done some things right and learned some things, but I was ready for a new character, and started making the early sketches for a book that would eventually be called The Kill Artist, starring a guy named Gabriel Allon. And I'm sure glad I picked him up, because he's been a godsend.
He's fabulous. That's when I came to read you. The reason I'm a little shaky on the earlier books
that's
is
okay.
The first one I read, in fact. Well, they've just been reprinted, so it's been hard to read them for a while. The first one I read was The Kill Artist. But, you know, it's interesting thinking about Northern Ireland. For some reason or other, there are just areas of the world or particular conflicts that don't seem to engage American readers. It's very difficult to do well with Northern Ireland. It's just,
you know,
I probably
learned that lesson. I think I was more interested than a lot of readers were, to be honest with you. And while I don't regret having written the book, it didn't do as well as some of my other ones.
Do you have any idea why it seems to be kind of a...
I don't know. Because I live in the East, where there are large Irish communities. And I grew up and lived in the Bay Area, where there was a huge Irish community. And so there was always interest in what was going on in Northern Ireland, where I lived. And so I guess I'm not as familiar with the rest of the country as those as other areas. But I think that where I lived, there was always a lot of interest in the story. New York, San Francisco.
Often, just as a bookseller, I often marvel on the things that do well. You can sell almost anything set in Italy. And Germany, almost impossible. France, very tough. Africa, almost impossible.
Hmm.
Only recently, really after the Cold War ended in probably the mid-90s, did people begin to move into the Far East. And so there were thrillers, some very fine thrillers or other kinds of books that were set there. But I'm always curious, you know, to just sort of figure out why readers will go some places with alacrity, and then seem sort of indifferent to others. And it's not about the writer. It's not obviously the quality of your book at all.
But I also think that to sit around and try to guess what they want to read is probably not terribly helpful.
Oh, no.
And I think with my first three novels, I really consciously tried to write what I thought were commercial thrillers that were going to be commercially viable. And when I just started writing the books that I wanted to write, they did a lot better.
You said actually a name that probably had some influence on you, Jack Higgins, because if anybody has in fact written much about Ireland or, you know, what is the name of his guy, Sean something?
He has a new character named Sean Dillon.
That's it.
He was an early influence on my work. I wouldn't really count him on as one of the guys who's influenced me in later stages of my
career. But if you've read him, that would have been some exposure.
Definitely.
Now, interestingly enough, Alan First was somebody whose books we used to bring over from England when he was kind of wandering in the wilderness before he wrote the...
Polish Officer?
No, it was the Kingdom. I'm going blank on the title. The one with the Hungarian...
Kingdom of Shadows?
Yeah, thank you. The Hungarian that comes to Paris, and it got a brilliant review in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like everybody said, oh, you know, look at this. I mean, here he'd been all this time. And then there's been a great interest in his work. I've always been a fan of Graham Greene. I've always liked the moral dilemmas that are at the heart of his books.
He's my man.
He is.
Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about Eric Ambler?
I worship Eric Ambler.
See, I was asked to do a quote for Dan Festerman the other day, who's another writer I think is working in the same sort of...
I have a book of his that came in the mail the other day that I'm really dying to read when I...
Which one did you get?
I don't know. It's set in the Balkans.
He wrote Lie in the Dark.
That's it.
Which is his first novel, won the John Creasy Best First Novel Dagger from Crime Writers. Brilliant book set in Sarajevo.
Yep.
Really liked it a lot. Then he wrote A Small Boat of Great Sorrows, which, as part of our discussion, where the detective is in Berlin. And, again, all kinds of echoes of World War II. It's
mm-hmm.
like Sins of the Fathers, you know, raining down on sons. But also, and we're just kind of, I think, at the outside edge where this is possible, a particular military figure from World War II is still alive and still doesn't want to be found. And, you know, I think... in terms of chronology, we're kind of getting to the end where that is a possible thing to do, to write a book in 2004 about somebody who was, you know, an active officer in the 40s is getting to be a stretch, but he has one in there. And I just think he writes brilliantly about the war theater and about the kinds of issues that have always engaged the writers I mentioned, but also engage you.
Yeah.
And Ambler came to mind, and he's the one I realized suddenly that everybody's quoting Green and First and whatever, and nobody's mentioning
Ambler. I mention him in everything that I do as an influence on my work. In a lot of ways, he invented or helped to invent the modern thriller.
Mm-hmm.
His you know, works like Journey into Fear are just sort of classic in their form and story. And he's, I mean, I really feel that I come much more out of that tradition, the British tradition, than the American one in terms of thriller writing.
I do too. I mean, I was thinking that to me, Ambler is the most direct ancestor,
definitely,
you know, of what you write. So, The Kill Artist, who is Gabriel Allon?
He, as a young man in 1972, he was an art student at the Beit Salel Academy of Art in Jerusalem, just fresh out of his compulsory army service. And something happened in Munich at the Olympic Games, the Munich Olympic Massacre, and the government of Israel decided to hunt down the perpetrators of that and kill them. And Gabriel is one of the guys that they draft for the hit team. He is a multilingual child of European Holocaust survivors, German Holocaust survivors, so he can work in Europe. And he is also, in later in life, becomes one of the world's finest art restorers. And they use that as his cover to move him around for his work. He came to me in just a flash of lightning, honestly. I was walking down the street with my wife, and I, as I said, I was just working on the sketches for this guy. And she says to me, "Don't forget, we're having dinner with David Bull tonight." And I stop in my tracks. David Bull, a friend of mine, truly is one of the world's finest art restorers. And I said, "That's it. He's an art restorer. He's an assassin. He's an art restorer." And I put the idea to get to David at dinner that night. He says, "Great, let's do it." So he takes me into the National Gallery in London, and you walk in there, and there's a Titian on this table and a Monet on this easel, and it's just incredible. And spent several days just teaching me about it, the techniques, the technical aspects of it, but really how to think like a restorer. And that's what has really made the series special. In my opinion, is that Gabriel, when he's doing his intelligence work, thinks like an art restorer always. And it's also put him in some wonderful settings. And for example, when he was investigating the Vatican's role in the Holocaust and the Confessor, he was restoring a church in Venice. It was an appropriate metaphor, in my opinion. And it makes the work special.
It really does. I think that's a wonderful scene that opens the Confessor. Kind of makes me think about Michelangelo and how he must have been lying, you know, to paint some
of his ceiling. I found something interesting on my book tour. Fellow who has been going to writing seminars at the University of Iowa told me that they were teaching that chapter as character introduction at a seminar at the University of Iowa writing program. And I was just tickled pink because it's one of the best things I've ever written, I just love that imagery there.
I did too. It's a brilliant scene, and of course, it also gives you a chance to write about Venice, even if it's not central to the rest of the story, which you know, which is such a romantic and interesting city.
But it was sort of central to it in that in the role of the ghetto and what took place there, and so it. It was more than just a pretty backdrop,
right.
Although it was a pretty backdrop, and I enjoyed my research there.
Yeah, but you're right, the ghetto, the whole thing. I was just in Rome and went to visit the synagogue in Rome, which I hadn't realized.
When were you there?
In November.
Were there still soldiers all
Absolutely.
Around?
Absolutely.
Isn't that lovely?
I'm myself Episcopalian, but my husband is from an important Jewish family, and I try to haul him along to see his own tradition. I'm actually more interested than he is. But yes, it was very unnerving. The front is all, you have to go around to a side door, and there's a museum there. But what I hadn't really thought about, and I know, you know, that this seemed incredible, that I wouldn't have figured it out before, I understood the ghetto in principle as a place where Jews lived. What I didn't really grasp was that they were actually
confined
locked in
there,
and what it meant in terms of Well, they were very good in Rome. They did a program when you visited the synagogue about the ghetto, about mm-hmm. the fact that it was flooded by the Tiber. It was before they had come along and done any sort of real flood control, how unhealthy it was. It was a picture that grew so sharp for me that I just hadn't given thought to before.
It was a sad and troubled history, the Pope's Jews, as they were.
Exactly.
I mean, they lived under the direct rule of the Vatican and the popes. And while Jews all around Europe were being emancipated, they were held under some pretty deplorable conditions and were trotted out once a year humiliated, ritually humiliated for the entertainment of the popes. And it's a sad and tragic story. And for me, it was particularly painful to go to services in the evening and have to pass through all that security and to see a community spill out into the street afterwards, guarded by Carabinieri men. It left a deep mark on me. And I think some of that sadness, I don't think there's any other word for it, just sort of crept into the tone of the confessor. But of course, it was the setting that the Great Synagogue of Rome, that was where my fictitious Pope Paul VII went to make his great pronouncement at the end of the book. And I think that ultimately why the confessor worked was that it was a very hopeful book, mm-hmm. as I meant it to be.
Why did you decide, this is another question I always find interesting, what is there that sort of magic about a trilogy? So often, you know, you hardly ever hear about anybody sitting down to write a quintet or a tetralogy.
Well, it all comes from Christianity. I mean, right? Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Threes. For me, I've called it an accidental trilogy because I didn't set out to write it. But I think that, look, it's a story, beginning, middle, end. It's threes. And I when I think about stories, every single book I think about it in thirds.
Sort of classical play structure.
It is classical play structure.
Yeah.
There's something about threes that the rhythm of it that works for us, whether it's music, a play, a book, three parts.
Although Alain, he comes along, Gabriel, in his first book, The Kill Artist, you actually do the, quote, trilogy. It starts with The English Assassin, and
right.
then The Confessor.
I call it a trilogy or cycle of three books.
Within
a broader series.
Right, and the theme that you're addressing more specifically in these three books is what?
I have labeled it the unfinished business of the Holocaust. In the first book, he dealt with Switzerland and the complicity of the Swiss banking system and Nazi art looting. Confessor obviously dealt with the Vatican. And this one, I had hinted throughout the series, or said throughout, that he was a child of Holocaust survivors. But I had never really walked up to it
right.
in terms of what it truly meant to him and his character. And I wanted to write about it, but also dramatize it. And not just tell it. And the result of that was this plot that I created for A Death in Vienna, where he is pursuing not only a man who is a major Nazi war criminal and a mover and shaker in the Austrian political scene, but a man who, as he finds out about midway through the story, had an encounter with his mother late in the war on the death march from Birkenau. I discovered something in my research and in talking to children of Holocaust survivors, and that is that people who lived through this experience oftentimes did not tell their children anything about it. And that was true of the Alain household, and it was true of a lot of families, particularly in Israel. Tough people, tough society, move on. The Holocaust itself was discussed endlessly, but people didn't really talk about their own personal experiences. And Gabriel knew nothing about what happened to his mother. Not to get into a lot of psychobabble, but it was sort of an unresolved. He brings some closure to that chapter of his life through this story.
Aren't you also, though, interested in the whole issue of Holocaust deniers?
I am very much so, and I started this book thinking that it was sort of the province of people who believe the Earth was flat and we never landed on the moon, and there are green men over in New Mexico, and I found out that's not the case. And actually, while I was working on the book, just sort of monitoring the various websites, case after case of this minister in Europe saying this ridiculous thing, that there was no anti-Semitism in Romania or something like that. And this one after the other, that flat out Holocaust denial, like we would see from a person like Mel Gibson's father, or shades of it, is very, very pervasive today. It is absolute gospel truth within the Muslim world. They believe that this never happened. It was an invention by the Jews. I mean that has really pervaded Islamic thinking about it. And it's a real thing. And so the story has a spine about denial, both the denial of the Holocaust and this weird denial, the strange denial that took place within families.
Absolutely. You know, I came to read it after a couple of years ago. I made a trip with a Northwestern alumni group to, my husband didn't want to go to Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. and I can certainly sympathize with that, but we were in Prague, mm-hmm. where there is a marvelous, still old Jewish community center. I was the only person on the tour that knew I needed to visit on Friday. The rest of them all thought they'd go on Saturday, and I started to say
Shabbat.
And I thought, to myself, so I kept quiet. But there's a, not only is the cemetery, but the memorial to the camp, which is very much like the Vietnam Wall, with all the names on the walls and all, is so stark and so tremendously moving and tear-producing and whatever. And from there, we went by train en route to the Danube to Nuremberg. And I want to tell you what, it was as though going around Nuremberg, it was as though the guide and the various people we talked to were referring to what the South calls the late unpleasantness. I mean, it was a really spooky. I mean, I'd just been in Prague looking at this, and now I'm in Nuremberg, where basically they are saying, you know, no big deal. It was just the late unpleasantness. You know, taking you to see the buildings where the war crime trials were held, taking you to see where Hitler actually spoke, and the whole thing was just complete. You know, sanitize it, denial, make it history, and all. I was flabbergasted. It's the first time I had run into Holocaust denial on a personal basis.
I chose Vienna for the setting for this story for a reason. I mean, the Viennese or the Austrians really did engage in a kind of denial themselves for many years.
And before the war too, weren't they the ones who you know behaved that way before the putsch?
Anti-Semitism has a long and sorry history in Austria. Although Vienna was it was a thriving Jewish community. It produced, mm-hmm. you know, the list goes on and on. Great musicians, artists, writers, Freud. But it took me from Vienna to the Czech Republic, my research did, to Warsaw and Treblinka. And back to Israel. So I sort of made this loop of this book. You know, being in Poland and being out there and going to Treblinka and finding the camp and walking there, it was an experience that I will never forget. I visited the camp on a day very much like I described in the book, just bitterly cold day in October. And it just takes your breath away. Still, I'll just never forget it.
You wrote very movingly about it on your website. I went to visit danielsilva.com.
danielsilvabooks.com.
Is it books.com?
I had to because there's a freight forwarding company in New Zealand that has my name.
I'm glad you said that. Actually, my shortcut was to Google, Daniel Silva, and then I didn't actually look. So thank you, danielsilvabooks.com. And I thought you wrote a very interesting and very moving description of your research this, and I was going to ask you, Treblinka sounds as though if you didn't know anything about it, if you went there, you wouldn't really have any keen awareness of why it was a memorial. Little bitty sign, heavily reforested.
Well, it was reforested by the Germans, of course. But it was always tucked into the woods for a reason, the White Forest of Poland. You would drive. You could drive right by it, and they just had these tiny little signs. And my driver kept missing them, and we were lost for a while. So we had to go through this rather bizarre sequence of pulling peasants over on the side of the road and saying which way to Treblinka. and finally found it. And it is a startlingly beautiful memorial. The government did it. It's almost too beautiful. But it every Jewish community that was destroyed there is represented by an appropriately sized stone, with a large stone in the middle of this meadow representing the Warsaw Ghetto. And the tracks, the railroad tracks, have been rebuilt in stone, and the rail platform has been rebuilt in stone. To get into the camp, you have to go over the real railroad track. That's you can hear that thud, 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 thud as you enter the camp. And it was, and I had it all to myself. It was no one else there. Pay your 2 zlotys and go in. And it was just, I'm glad I went.
I'm sure it lends an emotional resonance to the writing. Do you do that at the end of your books? Do
I
you
do
write
it at
the story
end.
And
yeah,
then
I
do
work
that?
On story, story, story. In fact, I wrote a version of that chapter before I had visited. And I ended up changing very little, actually. I got it right, so I just made a few little geographic changes to get some things right. But, you know, the dialogue and all the important things about the scene that between Gabriel and our guy, they all stay the same.
So undoubtedly one reason why your books have been so successful as fiction is that the story comes first with you and then all of this supports it.
Yeah.
There's a terrible danger, I think, a lot of writers fall into it, is you fall so in love with the research. I've been trained in the British pronunciation. Sorry, I don't dare say research anymore, as
research.
I get hammered in London. I have to say research. But I, you know, then what happens, of course, is it begins to overweight the story, or the story becomes shaped by what and you don't want to leave bits of it out. So it sounds to me as though you keep the story paramount.
Story first, and I have a couple of tricks for doing it, I get the story concept, broad outlines of the story, do enough research to get going, and then start writing, and then I research as I go along, and I get just enough research to do what I need, and I always, you got to dramatize it. That's what happens. You know, people just tell stuff. And just spill what they've learned onto the page without a scene around it, or some good characterization. That's when it becomes bloated and bad and weighty.
Or leaden.
Yes. I mean, we could go through the book chapter by chapter, but you know, the Austrian experience after the Anschluss is dramatized by a man named Max Klein, very effectively, I think. The Vatican's assistance to war criminals is done within the context of a debate, really, between Gabriel and the Pope's secretary. So I just try to use little tricks to show and dramatize rather than to just tell. When you feel yourself telling, just stop and think of some other way to do it.
I do think that the salient feature of the books is they suck you right through the story. I mean, I always enjoy, you know, traversing it without pausing to have to skip or skipping over some chunks of research. I find myself increasingly skipping parts of books. There's too much middle in a great number of books today, but yours I read.
Too much middle. I've never heard that phrase. Too much middle.
Too much middle. You know what? A really great novel has to have the end as good as the beginning. You have to have a payoff for the journey or the reader feels cheated. But if it sags a bit in the middle, you know, it's not so bad. And I find that a lot of books have really got unnecessary filler. But not yours. I think your pacing is particularly good.
Well, I cut tremendous amounts late in the process.
I'm not surprised. Most people, although it's hard for non-writers to understand that, I think actually most people overwrite, and the real secret of a really great book is to cut away the excess verbiage and get down to making a lean
but
and...
But scenes and scenes and scenes. And a guy at one of my signings the other night says, you know, your books are like plays. And I took that as a great compliment because I do think about book structure and scene structure, and I keep very careful count on scenes. I do not like, although it is some hop-around stuff in my early career, I've come to loathe it, and I really keep the point of view very controlled and the scene count down so that scenes come out. They do.
I mean, we can look at this book physically. You know, it's not one of these giant bloat.
It's 400.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a good.
It's an easy 400, though.
But it's I wasn't thinking of easy, but you can just sort of tell there's some books that just look leaden before you ever pick them up, let alone open the pages. So there you are. But I think you do brilliantly. Tell me, why is Vienna one of your favorite cities? I have a really mixed reaction to Vienna.
So do I. That makes it one of my favorite cities. It's changed a lot in the last couple of years because of the opening of the East. So they have tremendous amounts of tourists coming from the other direction these days. Buses and buses and buses from the Balkans and East. And so I love the center. I love the architecture and the streets. I can just wander around there. But as I put in the words of Gabriel Alon, it's a city of ghosts as well, and it has this terrible history. So it's, for me, it's also impossible not to walk the streets of Vienna and think about what happened there in March 1938. It's also difficult to go to services on Friday night, you know, within a couple hundred yards of the great cathedral and have to pass through a couple rings of Israeli security to go into a synagogue because of the anti-Semitism there. I did a lot of research. I talked to some people that work inside the community, trying to better relations between the two sides. And it's a real threat. It's not something to sneeze at. And I said, who's doing it? Who makes the threats? Who does the violence? Who does it? And they looked at me as if I were crazy, and they said, neo-Nazis, of course. I have mixed feelings about the place.
You know, I find the weight of empire presses upon it. It's a very grandiose city. It reminds me a bit of Buenos Aires in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of imperial buildings.
Definitely.
And it has great museums, and I had a fair amount of free time. We actually ended up staying there longer than we had planned, and to my great distress as an opera fan, we were there in the only month the opera house was dark, which I considered to be God laughing at me there. So I wound up in a lot of museums, and tremendous whole tracks of uniforms and things, you know, all these trappings of the military and of imperialism, and there's even like a continuously running film of the Franz Joseph's funeral, and, you know, the whole Habsburg thing was fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, it was a great power that fell apart.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not I did a bit of research on just the history of Austria. It's not a cohesive country in terms of its origins. There was people from here, people from there. And so I think there's a kind of a mixed up identity about what it exactly means to be an Austrian. And that comes through. But there's still, I was happened to be there on their National Day while I was doing the research, and there had a big military show in front of the Parliament building, and here's a country that I don't know when the last time their soldiers were on any battlefield, but boy, were they in love with those guns and tanks and airplanes. It was very interesting
and
to watch.
And uniforms, no doubt. I can't tell you how the uniform, I mean, what a deal that was. Of course, Vienna's also the home of Mozart, and, you know, to me, the music just is so omnipresent. I mean, call me shallow if you want, but if I could wave my hand and, like, restore anybody who died to life, Mozart is my man. I just can hardly stand the thought that he died. So just as some of this incredible music was beginning to flower, you know, I hear the magic flute, and I just want to scream that there's no more.
He left us with a lot, though.
He did, but, you know, I just can't, I'm so curious about what could have happened,
what else
you know.
Could happen?
Well, he was a man, I think, on the cusp of going, and, I mean, he was not a static kind of musician. He didn't just, and it's just, you can hardly imagine how music might be if he had lived long enough to express some of those ideas, and yet, you know, he might have just, that might have been it. I mean,
his talent depresses me, actually. I mean, just to think of someone so unbelievably gifted.
Do you remember the movie Amadeus?
Sure, it's one of my favorites.
There is this incredible moment, I think, and I'll never forget this, where he is standing there in the midst of familial, marital, and professional chaos, and you think he's at a billiard table, and he's rolling.
And he's writing.
And the music, and, you know, if you actually look at autographed manuscripts by Mozart, they're one draft. There are no
one drafts.
no corrections, no strikeouts, no amends, whatever. And I always think, you know, that he really was taking dictation from God.
And there was that
really
fabulous scene
it.
Where Salieri was looking at the sheets of music, going, where are the other drafts? Where are the other ones? Where are the other ones? I love that film.
Me too. He must have been impossible to live with because he was an interior, you know, he has to have been hearing that interior voice all the time. It's probably why his life was so chaotic otherwise.
I think most artists are probably impossible to live with.
Yeah, but he had the misfortune also not to marry somebody who could really look after him, and I think there was a whole combo. There's a very good book out at the moment by Stephanie Krall called Marrying Mozart, about his whole history with the Webern family and the Webern sisters. Mm. He kind of got to Constanza by default. Mm. And it's, I think it throws some well, we're going far
ahead.
Sorry.
Okay.
I just, you know, Vienna, Mozart, there I am. So where is it you think you're heading? Are you taking Gabriel into yet another book?
I'm taking him into at least one more book.
Cool.
I need to resolve a lot of threads about the story. And after that, I'm really not quite sure. I have some books I want to get to, books that wouldn't be Gabriel books, but I certainly wouldn't want to forsake the character.
Oh, no. He's so wonderful.
He's been very good to me, and we've been good to each other. And he and Shamron, Ari Shamron, I love them, and so I would... I think that whatever I do, you know, maybe would I alternate or try to write maybe a couple books a year? I don't know. But I do have some other things I'd like to get to.
When you thought about Gabriel, was the idea that his wife and child, you know, were victims of a terrorist bomb always there, or was that something you came to?
It was always there because I learned some lessons from the Osborne series, and that one of the lessons I learned is that it was very difficult to have a man of the secret world married. I thought I could do it, and it was fine, but I wanted to. I think that ultimately the genre almost demands a single man, but I didn't want to turn him into these, you know, typical guys who are getting all the girls all the time and sort of thing. I don't like a lot of romance in my stories. In terms of, I don't like that canned romance that gets thrown into every single plot where it has to be a girl, and in chapter 22 they have to have lurid sex. Those scenes always strike me as so silly. And so I looked for a way to deal with it, and that was the way I did. There are some scenes, the scene in which Gabriel sees her in The Kill Artist is probably one of the favorite things I've ever written, because, like, in all such situations, he thinks as a restorer and how he would like to be able to heal her as though she were a painting. So it was the way that I chose to make him human, to have a real love life and married life, not some sort of made up fantasy spy life, but to also to move her off the stage. And I think it worked, actually.
I think it works very well. I think he's a very tragic figure, but at the
he's
same
definitely a tragic figure.
As you say, it's made him connected, and yet at the same time, because they're dead, it makes him kind of the ultimate risk taker, because part of the deal, if he doesn't really care.
She's alive, actually, and that she is hospitalized in England.
Oh, that's right. She's in the coma.
Yeah,
and it was the child
and,
that
and,
died.
So it adds this other element to his.
Will
makes
she ever
it,
wake up?
Makes it well, no. But I'm going to involve her in the next plot. I won't tell how. But it
I
just makes it
you
makes
kept
his
her
more
off stage and yet didn't actually
yeah,
kill her.
Yeah, she's in a sort of a psychotic depressive state, near catatonic, and just sort of this living, almost human gravestone in a way, and I think it works very well.
Well, it also provides him with not an excuse, but I mean, he's not thus free to just marry somebody else should that ever come up.
Right.
He's
involved with someone right now.
Yeah, he is. No, I know. I like the character very much in Death in Vienna.
Yeah, Chiara. We introduced her in the confessor, and I just loved her. And she was sort of inspired by some people I met in Venice when I was working on the confessor.
That's a very interesting dynamic. Dick Francis did it particularly well in one book, the name of which I cannot remember, but it's the one where he has his hero in an iron lung. I mean, sorry, his hero's wife has been stricken with polio and is in an iron lung. And so the guy has got that, you know, he has to be there to support his wife and whatever, but yet at some point he wants some sort of emotional life, sex life, whatever it is, and how is all that to be handled? And there's a woman not dissimilar to Chiara who comes into the story and who is content to have him in
whatever way.
Yeah, doesn't have any problem with his loyalty to his wife. And, you know, it is a very interesting book, a very bittersweet book, actually.
Chiara's starting to make some noises, though. She's like a little more of Gabriel, I think. Mm.
Well, you know what? You set these people in motion. You're just going to have to
deal
with the emotional storm.
But that's what the, you know, create a good character and let them tell you what to do. That's the way I like to. And Chiara, that's the way Chiara would play it, I think. She'd be willing to wait for him for a while, but not forever.
So are you satisfied with being a fiction writer?
Definitely.
This is really what you wanted to do?
Definitely. Definitely.
Word has reached me that this is your first book tour. Are you finding that unnerving? Exciting? Do you like connecting with readers face-to-face?
I like connecting with readers face-to-face. I am a terribly shy person, and so I don't, you know, to get up and stand in front of a bunch of people is not what I really like to do.
If only they could send me with you.
I've really enjoyed it, actually. It's been hard, and I miss my children terribly, but the bookstore events have been terrific. I've met lots of people, lots of readers, and the feedback is very helpful, actually.
I find that most writers say that the thing that's the most valuable to them about book tours is that direct reader feedback. Yeah. I always try to encourage a question-and-answer period because, I mean, some of the questions are the usual tiresome thing, but sometimes you get the most extraordinary comments and really moving.
Comments, but to realize that you do have fans, that people like you.
Actually,
and
you know
it's
what?
Very helpful.
I don't think it's that so much. Then it is the fact that what you realize, at least what I see writers, I can't speak for you, but I can speak for my own reaction. What I see sort of throwing them is the fact that their characters have become real, that people are really invested in the lives of these people that you have dreamt up, created, and they care about them in a way that must be difficult for you as the creator to imagine.
No, they seem very real to me. I had always thought that people, writers who said, you know, they talk to their characters or their characters are sitting around them while they work, I'd always thought that was a little
Ooh,
bit
stuff.
Of exaggeration, they really are as real to me as just about anyone. And I spend more time with them than I do with people in the overt world.
You certainly talk to them, or they talk to you.
They talk to me, and you know, every morning when I walk down there and close the door in my office, I'm in their world, and I spend more time with them than I do with living people. So
do you leave them there successfully when you exit the office?
No, and purposely so. When I'm working on a book, I'm afraid I'm terribly preoccupied. I work a lot of hours in the day. I bring my manuscript upstairs to bed with me at night and read before I go to sleep. I let the subconscious mull it over. I keep them with me all the time. I just find it's easier to sort of stay in character than it is to come out in and out of character. So I'm a little bit preoccupied. I'm told I have a problem with preoccupation.
I think it's a problem. Well, it's a problem we should be grateful for if it is a problem. But I had a most unnerving comment, at which I'm going to close this program, from a writer who was here recently. And I can't remember exactly how it came up because she wasn't much of a drinker, but somehow the whole thing of writers and alcohol came up, and I said, I often wonder, because I can't read and drink. I mean, it just doesn't work for me. And I said to her, I can't figure out how people can write and drink. And she said, and here's what she said, which I thought was fascinating. She said, we have to drink to turn the voices off.
Not me. I don't touch the stuff.
I just thought that was, you know, the most dramatic comment on how real a writer, in fact, is in this interior world.
We'll close on alcohol. I'll drink wine on vacation, but I work so early in the morning, and then those first few minutes, couple of hours when I wake up, are the productive time, and to have any kind of alcohol lethargy or any kind of hangover, I can't deal with that.
Well, I'm glad you won't turn into Dashiell Hammersager in front of me.
Not me.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed it, and I want to thank all of you for this visit with us on the Criminal Calendar. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.